across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 9, 2003. From the WTO ministerial meetings in Cancun, Mexico, I'm Vipa Fernandez. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz went to Capitol Hill today to follow up on the Bush administration's call for an additional $87 billion for the occupation of Iraq. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon travels to India to seal an arms deal. And with the WTO meeting slated to start in Cancun tomorrow, water is a big issue. We look at the failure of water privatization in Cancun. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Attorney General John Ashcroft took his whistle stop toward justifying the so-called Patriot Act to Boston today. Chuck Rosina was there.
While Attorney General John Ashcroft's national tour came rumbling into historic Faneuil Hall in Boston this morning, he was met by more than 1,000 demonstrators who opposed this legislation and what it has done to our civil liberties and constitutional rights. With little lead time, the rally was hastily organized through the internet and community radio, which helped galvanize a boisterous turnout on an early weekday morning. Amongst the many speakers was Susan Akram of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee.
As Muslims and Arabs, United States citizens and lawful permanent residents, our questions are, what about those over 1,000 arrests of people from our communities, detained, without access to counsel? Now you've come up with a new innovation called monitoring attorney-client conversations.
The American people, at least in Boston, are speaking out against the attacks on our civil liberties. John Ashcroft left Boston this morning to take his tour to New York City, where he was expected to be met with an even larger demonstration. Reporting from Boston, this is Chuck Rosina for Free Speech Radio News.
The Indian government rejected a petition by AIDS activists to decriminalize homosexual activity in the country. Miranda Kennedy has a story from New Delhi.
The Indian Penal Code reads, "Whoever voluntarily has sex against the order of nature with any man, woman, or animal shall be punished with imprisonment for life or with imprisonment which may extend to 10 years. The government yesterday said this law is constitutional because society's disapproval is strong enough to justify homosexuality being treated as a criminal offense. The NAS Foundation, which works with HIV and AIDS patients, had challenged the law, saying consensual homosexuals were not seeking medical help because they feared police action against them. But their appeal was rejected, giving India company in its harsh laws against homosexuality are most of the Islamic world. In the Western world, only Bulgaria, Romania, and the Vatican outlaw homosexuality. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New Delhi.
Thousands of students who arrived from Mexico City last night wound through the hotel zone of Cancun today, establishing their right to be in the streets as the World Trade Organization ministerial and accompanying protests are set to begin tomorrow. From the Cancun Independent Media Center, Renee Feltz has more.
Starting from the student encampment and stopping at the Campesino Forum along the way, the spontaneous march came to the convention center where trade delegates are set to meet tomorrow. Surrounded by a 10-foot-high fence now draped with banners opposing the globalization of imperialism and war, the center was host to a dedication ceremony. Activists formed a circle and fell silent as water and earth were offered to higher powers. Police with helmets and shields stood behind the convention center fence and were non-confrontational. Shade and a fountain in a nearby park, not yet fenced off, provided a peaceful area for protesters to rest in the hot sun. More protests with more attention are expected tomorrow. From the Cancun Independent Media Center, this is Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
People earning minimum wage in the United States are unable to afford decent housing, according to a report issued by the National Low Income Housing Coalition. In some states, even if two or three people in the household earn the minimum wage, it would be impossible to pay for a two-bedroom rental unit in most cities. Kim Schaefer, a spokesperson for the organization, believes the crisis requires more than relying on developers and market forces.
You'll find developers who build towards the higher end of the market because that's where their profits are. The problem becomes that people earning low or moderate incomes just don't have anywhere to go. And so it's really important to make that public investment. I mean, this, what we're talking about is housing. I mean, this is a market failure.
The most expensive states are Massachusetts, California, New York, and New Jersey. Overall, the coalition reports housing costs have risen 37% since 1999. Yet the fastest growing job area of the national economy is the service sector, where workers average the lowest wages, often working only part-time jobs with few or no benefits. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Randy Zimmerman.
Haaretz is reporting that at least 4 people have died and some 15 were wounded when a Palestinian suicide bomber detonated outside an Israeli army base near Tel Aviv today. This as the Israeli military continued its practice of extrajudicial assassinations in the occupied Palestinian territories over the weekend, including a failed attempt to assassinate Hamas's spiritual leader, Sheikh Ahmad Yassin. Another failed assassination attempt in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis injured 11 Palestinian bystanders. Meanwhile, Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kurai began assembling his new cabinet today, vowing to achieve a ceasefire on the conditions that Israel end the construction of the security fence, the extrajudicial assassinations, and the removal of roadblocks, as well as a freeze on settlement activities. Ouad Dwabez has more from Ramallah.
Palestinian President Yasser Arafat nominated Ahmed Kurai less than 24 hours after the resignation of Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas resigned just before a planned closed session of the Palestinian Legislative Council, which was dedicated to examine his first 100 days in administration, and less than 8 hours after his resignation, Yasser Arafat announced he accepted it. The resigned Prime Minister was demanding larger authorities, mainly over security services, from the Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. But Abbas said Israel's failure to implement measures within the peace talks was the main reason behind his decision. Abbas faced a lot of criticism from the Palestinian population, but also from his own Fatah movement. Ahmed Ibouini, chief of Fatah Youth Organization in Ramallah, said his movement demanded the resignation of Abbas.
Palestine's government didn't achieve the minimum of the inspirations of our people, did not negotiate political issues, but was a tool in the Israeli and American hands. And above all, this government treated our legitimate struggle as if it is terrorism.
And for Palestinians on the ground, Israeli measures to prove their commitment to the peace process have been lacking. According to Reem, who works in a research center, this is an internal Palestinian affair, but she admits that Israeli positions are important in its success.
Actually, no Palestinian would be satisfied with that. I think it's a Palestinian internal issue. I don't think a change within the Palestinian Authority should be a result of an external pressure, such as an Israeli or an American pressure. The Israelis are making things really hard for the Palestinians, and I think the stalemate will lead to the same result, since Israel tightens things and makes things harder for the Palestinians. I mean, in reality.
As for Azmi, who works in a cultural center in Ramallah, he believes Kurai will face the same failure, since the main reason behind Abbas' resignation is the Israeli attitude toward peace.
When Abu Mazen resigned, he said the true reasons were that the Israelis and Americans didn't give him anything to show the Palestinian people that he really did something on the ground. The same situation will face Kurai. He will be facing the exact same problems.
Israel escalated its extrajudicial assassinations. A foreclosure was also imposed on the Palestinian territories, barring them from moving to Israeli proper or even between their own cities and villages. Amal Davis reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
The U.S. Army announced it will extend the tours of the National Guard and the Army Reserve forces in Iraq for several more months than originally anticipated. Critics of the move say the Bush administration is over-relying on reservists that could adversely affect retention and recruitment that could lead to a breakdown of the reservist system. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is continuing its plea to Congress for an additional $87 billion for its military endeavors. Most of the $87 billion will go to Iraq, with $66 billion for military support and only $21 billion for Iraqi infrastructure. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz and Joint Chief Chairperson General Richard Myers took Bush's appropriation request to the Senate Armed Services Committee today. Mitch Jeserich was there, and he files this report.
Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz told Congress at the Senate Armed Service Committee the request for $87 billion appropriation for the war on so-called terrorism must be passed quickly.
We know that Osama bin Laden saw Somalia as an example of how Americans can be driven out by inflicting casualties. We know that Saddam Hussein told Ambassador April Glaspie in 1990 that he could take massive casualties and we couldn't stand even a few. The sooner these terrorists and Baathists understand clearly that our will can't be broken and that the Iraqi people, despite hardship and difficulty, will persevere in building their new society, the sooner we will win.
Even though active reserves in Iraq have been told they won't be coming home as soon as they thought, and some officials say the military is stretched too thin around the world, Joint Chief Chairperson General Richard Myers told the committee that the military doesn't need more U.S. troops to pacify Iraq.
The terrorists have said and think they're going to win. They're absolutely wrong about that. They will not win. They can't win. We can't let them win. And we won't. We're not going to win as long as we have the continuing will of the American people, and for that matter, freedom-loving people everywhere.
Myers did acknowledge that some Iraqis don't want the United States in their country, but Wolfowitz and Myers say they are waiting for the international community to send more troops, though as of now it's not sure that will happen unless the U.S. relinquishes some of its power in Iraq. Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona supported the invasion, but he is also critical of the Bush administration's handling of it.
When we have to extend Guard and Reservists on active duty, when we have to ask for international forces, when we have to do the things that we are doing, it's clear to me that we need additional troops and we need of certain specialties, intelligence, civil affairs, special forces, Marines, not just more tanks.
Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts called President Bush's plan the wrong idea at the wrong time. And he says Bush must make his new plans clear if he expects the American people to hand over $87 billion that has been requested.
Now, in the address to the nation on Sunday, I had hoped to hear acknowledgement from the president about our failures in Iraq, the war on terrorism, and the administration's concrete plans for setting the course right with our allies and through the United Nations. The administration's made a U-turn in its policy, but it doesn't know which direction it's going in, I don't believe. The president's asked us for the $87 billion next year for our occupation of Iraq, but essentially a blank check.
Only a small amount of the $87 billion requested would go towards building the infrastructure of Iraq. About $66 billion would go towards the military to quash the American resistance in both Iraq and Afghanistan. The National Council on Disability called on the U.S. to spend more money on helping people with disabilities cope in war-torn areas. Kathy Martinez with the council says war is the greatest cause of people obtaining some type of disability and is also the greatest deterrent for disabled people to function in their own societies.
Upwards of 20% of people are disabled in post-armed conflict situations. And I know that in Afghanistan there has been a concerted effort to make things accessible, but that was because there was a mandate. And currently what we would like to see is a similar mandate for Iraq, the reconstruction of Iraq.
Wolfowitz complained to the Armed Service Committee that the press is only reporting on the bad events in Iraq and not enough on the good events. Meanwhile, military families speak out or participating in a congressional briefing. Some family members testified that their sons and daughters signed up to serve their country so to defend the Constitution, not to be used as cannon fodder in a reckless military misadventure. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jeserich in Washington.
And you're listening to Free Speech Radio News. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Ariel Sharon is in India today. He's the first Israeli Prime Minister to visit. He's holding four-day talks to seal a defense deal. Indian officials have expressed a desire to purchase the Falcon radar system and the Arrow missile system from Israel. For Israel, an alliance with India means a big weapons market and a strong ally to target a common enemy, what they call Islamic terrorism. Meanwhile, Sharon's visit was met with demonstrations in major cities protesting Sharon's visit, saying India was sending a wrong message to Palestinians by inviting the Jewish leader. Our correspondent in Delhi, Vinod K. Jose, has the details.
Marching on the streets, burning effigies. This is how many political and religious organizations welcome Ariel Sharon's visit to India. India welcomed many world leaders after its independence, but it never dared to invite an Israeli prime minister in the past 5 decades. And it has been strongly supporting the Palestinian struggle. But of late, bilateral ties in defense purchase and defense training and a Hindu right coming to power in India has brought the administration of these two countries together. The lobbying in the United States and Israel is characterized by what they call a Washington-Tel Aviv-New Delhi Axis Alliance. But the people seem to be coming out of the streets in large numbers to protest Ariel Sharon's visit. One of the organizations in attendance today was the All India Students Association. Kavita Krishnan is their national president.
We are here to say, Ariel Sharon, go back. You have blood on your hands. We believe that Ariel Sharon heads a racist, genocidal, colonial regime in Israel, which has taken the lives of thousands of innocent Palestinians.
Dr. Dinesh Vashne is a professor in Delhi University.
We personally believe that Sharon's visit to India is a denigration in the right of the Palestinian people, in the right of the independence-loving people. And Vajpayee inviting Sharon, in a way, is subjugating the interest of the entire Palestinian people.
But the Indian administration is not disturbed by the noisy demonstrations of the people. Ranjit Singh, a former advisor in External Affairs Ministry.
It's very easy to label people, but the fact is that he is Prime Minister of Israel, and we welcome him as a Prime Minister of Israel.
India has been spending an estimated $1.5 billion to $2 billion US dollar every year on Israeli military technology and equipment. India and Israel are currently negotiating Falcon radars costing $1.5 billion price tag. How serious Israel is about a futuristic Indian market is evident in the configuration of Ariel Sharon's team. Closely half of his 124-member team is businessmen. Again, Ranjit Singh, former advisor to India's foreign minister.
India is one of the biggest markets for Israeli products. I mean, I think we have overtaken Turkey. This is what the newspapers were saying. So from that point of view, it's certainly India is a very major market as far as Israel is concerned. And I think they are keen to develop this market.
Other than business, Israel found a welcoming Hindu right government in India who agree on Islamic terrorism. Achin Vinayak is a senior scholar in political science in India.
The more fundamental aspects are the political aspects. The fact that there is a group of people in power in India who hate Muslims, who admire Israel, who think that Zionism as an exclusionary nationalist ideology is the kind of thing that should also come in India via Hindutva.
Bhim Singh is the president of Jammu and Kashmir Panthers Party. He is calling the pressure groups and ministers working for ties with Israel as agents of CIA.
How much Brijesh Mishra knows about Palestine? They are all small foggies, small little agents of the CIA. I don't know whether your radio carries this, but I say it with full authority and claim.
Kavita Krishnan, the student leader.
BJP would like to project like Israel is this Jewish Rashtra, Jewish nation. India is a so-called Hindu nation surrounded by Muslim terrorists and so on and so forth, threatened. And also they see a comparison that Israel is supposedly the original ancient homeland of the Jews. And they would like to paint a picture that India too is this ancient original homeland of the Hindus. But this is a picture which common Indians have rejected, which they will never accept, and which BJP is going to see them rejecting in the coming elections in a big way. And reality is that whether it be Bush, whether it be Advani's, Modi's and Vajpayee, whether it be Ariel Sharon, these are the international terrorists. These are the people who are sponsoring mass massacres of innocent civilians. What can we call them if not terrorists?
From New Delhi in India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Stephen Funk, a 21-year-old gay, half-Filipino Marine reservist who filed for conscientious objector status, was found guilty of unauthorized absence this past Saturday and sentenced to 6 months in a military prison. The case was watched closely by anti-war activists and conscientious objectors around the country. Sarah Olson has the details.
Stephen Funk is the first conscientious objector to be court-martialed for his position against this year's war in Iraq. He was also one of the only conscientious objectors who spoke out publicly against the war. Funk was originally charged with desertion with intent to shirk important duty.
Our defense to that was that as a conscientious objector, he knew at the time he didn't report that he would not be required to engage in important service.
Stephen Collier represented Funk during the court-martial.
I think it's very important that we beat the desertion charge because really what happened was is he was absent without leave or he had an unauthorized absence. By trying to elevate it into a desertion charge, the Marine Corps was taking a position that everyone who misses their activation is a deserter.
Free Stephen Funk!
No!
Incarceration!
Free!
Activists around the country rallied in support of Stephen Funk, who they claim is a symbol of resistance in the United States today. Renee Salcedo is a representative of the Day Labor Program in San Francisco. She spoke at a demonstration last Thursday night.
Joining my brothers and sisters in the LGBT community, immigrant community, and all oppressed peoples to honor you, Stephen Funk. Because, among other things, you are a symbol of resistance against the immoral invasion and occupation of another country by the imperialist United States.
Funk is concerned about the ongoing recruiting in schools and hopes that his decision to speak out publicly will help others decide to resist the military.
Because of the fact that it's an economic draft and defending our country and defending the Constitution and Bill of Rights isn't the number one reason why people join, it makes sense that people are joining without even thinking about war. They're joining because they feel they have to, otherwise they might not survive. I've talked to several people about their feelings about this war especially, and I've had a lot of people come up to me in support of what I did.
Amy Allison was a combat medic and a conscientious objector in the 1991 Iraq War. She helped to guide Funk through the process of filing conscientious objector paperwork. She says that it is very important for military personnel to speak publicly about their opposition to the war.
In a sense, members of the U.S. military are in the belly of the beast, and they are in the most powerful position to make a statement against the decisions that the Bush administration are making to wage war in theaters all over the world and wage sustained war.
Jeff Patterson was the first military personnel who refused to fight in the 1991 Iraq War. He claims that the military jury's decision to acquit Funk of desertion is a victory for the defense. He says that Stephen's case fits into a national movement against military recruiting and a global movement against occupation.
Well, many people are taking up a campaign in the high schools and on college campuses to oppose military recruiting and let people have the facts about military life to get beyond just the glossy sell of military recruiters. And Stephen Funk is part of that, in that we're going to uphold him as a hero who's somebody who stood up, spoke out, and did the right thing in the face of an unjust war. And beyond that, there are international protests coming up on September 28th of this month, international protests against war and occupation.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Olson.
Water privatization is a big issue on the agenda of the trade ministers at the upcoming WTO meetings beginning in Cancun tomorrow. Privatizing water is a phenomenon occurring worldwide, yet the chorus of voices against the practice is also growing. One of the world's largest water companies, French-based Suez, has concessions all over the world, from the Philippines to Poland, and even here in Cancun. Yet as communities here in Cancun testify to, privatizing water has actually made water much less accessible. An elderly couple lived directly opposite one large water tank in Cancun, yet as Maria, not her real name, explains, their small house has been without basic water services for the past 17 years. Well, here we have no water. We don't have problems with the government themselves, but with the rich people that come here and want to buy our land to build grand hotels. And it is them who want to kick us off our land. Yahaida Davidia is the spokesperson for Agua Khan, who run the water system in Cancun. Agua Khan is 50% controlled by the French water corporation Suez, one of the world's top three water companies.
And the idea is that the concession implies drainage services, water services, agua potable, and sanitation as well. So it's all three aspects of the water services that are provided. It's an integral concession.
It's not a good quality water. Nobody drinks water in here. If you want to drink fresh water, you have to buy containers of purified water.
That was Arturo Moss, Cancun resident and activist. Moss points out that not only is the water that Aguacan provides far from usable, many people do not even have the basic services that Aguacan claims to provide.
In Cancun, in the hotel zone, they have water 24 hours a day. But here in Cancun and the suburban areas, the water service is very limited, only for 2 or 3 hours per day. Official numbers of this company and the government says that almost 80% of the people in here has fresh water. Only 80%. But less than 40% of the people has sewage water system. So you can imagine all the waste disposals of almost 400,000 people that lives in Cancun goes directly to subsoil.
The issue of water at the WTO meeting here now is going to be primarily centered around the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services.
Karen Koch is the water project coordinator for the Polaris Institute.
The General Agreement on Trade and Services, what it facilitates, what it aims to facilitate, is the liberalization of service markets, and that includes water. So what that means is cutting back and breaking down all barriers to foreign investment in domestic water services, which in a lot of places are largely public. So it means eliminating public subsidy and these sorts of things. So what effectively it means is that it's trying to eliminate all protections to public water systems and opening them all up for foreign private companies to come in and take them over.
Koch adds that there may not be any firm agreements about water privatization this round of the WTO meetings because she says activist pressure has made water a hot-button issue, making complete privatization difficult to sell. However, as Mai Phil Flynn of Public Citizen points out, also, inside the halls of the WTO meetings, little deals that trade ministers and corporations will make will essentially lead to the full privatization of water systems worldwide. Large companies like Suez, she says, just need a foot in the door.
Where I come from, in Washington, D.C., Suez has a service contract, which means they're just reading the meters and giving the bills That's out. What? If you go to the World Bank website that is supporting this, that's giving loans to in order to do this, you can see on their website, on their information, that they say, well, the way to get full privatization is to start out with a service contract, just do the billing and so forth, and then you talk the city into doing the whole management.
Cancun is just the tip of the iceberg. Over the last few years, Suez and its biggest rival, Vivendi, have been signing long-term deals, some for up to 50 years, to manage municipal water systems from the Philippines to Poland. Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mesta, Simba Russo, with Aaron Glantz. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Josh Chaffin. Our technical production team is Jade Pageant-Seekins, Pauline Bardalone, and Lindsay Benedict. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. We also have technical assistance from our intern, Bob Stern. I'm Deepa Fernandez.